Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a trip to a fountain pen warehouse takes an unexpected turn, and the next installment of our Overwhelmed series, looking at how the state tries and often fails to care for patients with severe mental illness. But first, since President Trump took office for the second time, there are three letters that have, in the president's formulation, become synonymous with everything from wasteful government spending to ineffective air traffic control. DEI. DEI stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and it's sort of an umbrella term, often used to describe programs that supporters say help to balance out historical underrepresentation of marginalized groups in academic, corporate, and government life. But Trump has done everything in his power to forbid such policies at the federal level and has threatened to revoke federal funding from organizations that have DEI programs. Trump's threats seem to have resonated in offices outside of the government's purview as well. Various private corporations like Target, McDonald's, and Harley-Davidson have rolled back or canceled DEI initiatives. And last week, we saw the local impact of all this when Scottsdale's city council voted to close its office of DEI. Joining us now in studio to talk about this is Councilwoman Solange Whitehead, one of the council members who voted to keep that office open. Councilwoman, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here again.
Thank you for being here. So take us back to this vote. How did the ordinance that is going to close the office come to be before the council?
So the ordinance came about in a very unusual way. Ordinances usually have public input, a justified need, and then public outreach, and public discussions at the council level. So none of that happened with this. And the ordinance really is based on the false premise that by passing the ordinance, the city would institute merit-based hiring. And of course, the city has always done merit-based hiring, so no ordinance was ever needed. And the target was this very small Office of Diversity. And I say Office of Diversity because the city of Scottsdale has had it since 1989. And it has had many names, but the purpose has always been the same, and it had nothing to do with HR.
Yes, this is an interesting facet of Scottsdale's Office of Diversity or Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, as it's been called various things over the years.
Correct.
But unlike a lot of places which instituted programs like this in the wake of the George Floyd protests in 2020, Scottsdale's office has been open for, I believe it's since 1998. Is that right?
I think it's 89.
Oh, since 89. I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm sorry. So a very, very long time.
It has been, yes.
Tell us some of the things that the office has done that have sort of a practical impact on Scottsdale folks' lives.
So I think generally, I think when people think of diversity, they think black or white or some sort of race issue. And our diversity is very, very broad and very nuanced. So we have economic diversity. We have ageism. We have we have a workforce, and not just in the city government, but more, you know, in our hospitals, in our other businesses that's diverse. So what this department has done for, 30 years is it has created a safe and welcoming culture in the city. And I think that's the foundation of our success. Last year, we had 11 million visitors from around the world come to Scottsdale, and they were safe and they enjoyed themselves. And this is part of what this department has done.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, this is one of your concerns and one of the reasons that you voted in favor of keeping the office open is the message that, in your view, closing the office sends to folks who come to visit Scottsdale.
Yeah, I think extremism has hurt the country in many ways. And so there have been some DEI abuses, and I absolutely agree with that. But in Scottsdale, we've had extremism on the other side, which I don't think there is one side or another. Extremism is bad. It's not left or right.
Yes, it's equal opportunity.
Equal opportunity wrong. And so in, 2004, a bomb was opened in the Office of Diversity. Three staff members were severely injured, and this was extremism. So this is exactly the type of thing we're trying to stop. And so if you have an extremist ordinance pass, which takes down posters that simply show the diversity of people who live and visit here, that sends a message too.
Yeah. Well, so obviously, you know, you're talking about from your own perspective, the what you view as the importance of this office. But if I'm not mistaken, you also heard from a large number of constituents who did not want the office to be
closed. Oh, my gosh. I have been in office for 6 years and I've never received so many emails. None of these emails were the same, and just hundreds of emails absolutely opposing this, because it's the wrong time in our country to end discussion. It's the wrong time to divide. We have so much common ground in this country, and we need to stop letting extremists on either side prevent us from talking about what we agree on. And that's the message we got. We've got to keep talking with each other. And in fact, we agree on most issues as a nation.
Well, let's talk a little bit more then about how we got to this moment. We have just about a minute left here. And what do you see as the way forward? This conversation has, as you've been pointing out, become very inflamed.
Yes. So I've received emails from both sides. When I put out an email saying I was disappointed that this office was closed down, and we frankly don't even know what that means, but it encompassed everything from ADA to the LGBT community. But what was interesting to me is the people who wrote in support of ending literally a couple hundred thousand dollars of funding to the people who absolutely opposed it said the same thing. Everybody in the city, as far as I can tell, wants equity-based hiring, merit-based hiring. We do that. And everybody wants to be safe, and everybody wants to be welcoming and to continue to thrive.
Well, Councilwoman Solange Whitehead, obviously there is always more to discuss with this, but thank you for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
In part three of our series, Overwhelmed, KJZZ's Amy Silverman and Athena Ankra sit down with the sister of a man diagnosed with both schizophrenia and autism who was recently a patient at the Arizona State Hospital. She says her brother only got worse at ASH, which worries her because autism runs in this family. Here's Amy Silverman.
How do you say, Ryan? Can you say hi?
Hi!
Hi.
Look.
Can you ask them what's your name?
On a midweek afternoon in early November, Summer Walter and her son Ryan welcomed visitors to their Mesa home. The house was already decorated for Christmas, per Ryan's request. The tall, dark-haired young man is curious about the visitors' radio equipment.
Hello!
Ethan, Walter's older son, keeps a distance. Both young men, 18 and 20, have autism, but it presents differently in each. Ryan is physically affectionate and has a lot to say. Ethan is a little more complicated.
He's my lover. He's the non-verbal one, type 1 diabetes, a lot of the health stuff.
Every couple hours, including during the night, Walter pricks Ethan's finger to check his blood sugar.
Both Ryan and Ethan tower over their mom. Toddler toys like stackable rings and a little tyke's plastic keyboard crowd the kitchen table. On the fridge, there's a hand-drawn Valentine, an arithmetic worksheet, and phone numbers for doctors. Ryan retreats to his bedroom, obviously bored. Ethan wanders the living room, iPad in hand, watching Sesame Street. After a bit, he trades the tablet for a big pink ball and stands patiently by the back door till Walter opens it.
Oh, are you ready to go outside?
Okay.
Outside, on the concrete patio, Ethan bounces the ball repeatedly. His mom says he can do it for hours.
On this warm autumn afternoon, the house is calm. That's not always the case. A few weeks later, Walter posts a bathroom mirror selfie on Instagram. She's looking straight ahead, wearing giant safety goggles over her long brown hair. The caption, When your kiddo has autism and likes to poke your eyes out when you're trying to assist him in the bathroom, this becomes your new safety attire. Walter added a laughing emoji to the post, but in the photo, her eyes are exhausted. The threat to her safety is real, but she worries more about her sons than herself. She knows the worst-case scenario.
Autism was not new to Walter when her sons were diagnosed as little boys. She has both a half-brother and a half-sister who are autistic. Their upbringing was traumatic, Walter says, and she'd fallen out of touch with her brother Darren Beach for more than a decade when she saw a familiar face one day on the television news.
Just in, an arrest after an accused arsonist is caught on camera torching an LGBT youth center. Police tracking down Darren Beach Jr.
Newscasters were reporting an arson attack on a Phoenix LGBTQ youth center called One in Ten. Walter watched the security footage of a tall, wide-set man in a blue hoodie walking around the inside of the building, pouring gasoline. Walter visited her brother in jail as soon as she could. Since she'd last seen him, Beach had been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder and was living on the street. He was found guilty but insane in the arson case and sent to the state hospital in 2021.
Walter says Beach got worse at Ash, not better, in part because he was not given accommodations for his autism.
He just kept getting increasingly aggressive. So you take someone with autism and you throw them into this sensory overloading, stimulating unit where patients are constantly attacking each other, or staff is being attacked by the patients. And so that is what really made the shift in Darren's stay at Ash. That's when they started increasing all the meds, changing meds, flipping the meds. I mean, it's abusive. It's just abusive what they did to Darren.
Not only did Ash not provide accommodations, she says hospital medical staff removed Beach's autism diagnosis.
They took the time to have him evaluated by somebody who is not credentialed or versed in autism. They undiagnosed him with autism at Ash so that they're like, he doesn't have autism. And I'm like, but he does. He's had this long-standing diagnosis since he was like 4. You don't magically not have autism anymore.
We begin tonight with a man being sentenced to jail time after assaulting an employee at the Arizona State Hospital while he was a patient.
Almost 2 years into his stay at Ash, Beach was found guilty of aggravated assault against an Ash employee and sent to jail. The 9 medications he was on at the time did not follow him, and Walter says he began having a physical reaction that culminated in a psychotic break. Beach declined KJZZ's request to be interviewed. He has not spoken to media since the arson incident.
Walter is disappointed in the system and herself.
I was very naive in thinking like, oh, this is going to be a piece of cake. I'm going to be able to get Darren all kinds of help. This is going to be great. He's going to get out of jail and life is going to be awesome for him. I don't even think there's a word to describe what has happened with Darren and his situation. Just epic failure, just an epic, disgusting, awful failure.
Watching her brother's experience has forced Walter to rethink how she approaches difficult situations involving her son, Ethan.
We stopped having in-home providers come in because I didn't want them to get hurt. So I'm Ethan's habilitation provider now. Because I just feel awful. I know some families are like, oh, well, that's their job. And if they just get beat up, you know, I'm like, no, that's how you lose providers. My husband and I have a deal. We're like, no, we're just going to let Ethan beat the shit out of us because we're not calling the police.
It takes too long for help to arrive, Walter says. And when it does, the officers are often not trained to deal with people with autism and mental illness.
Walter pauses as Ethan, done with the ball, hands her a container of Reese's peanut butter cups. Okay, she says, but first his blood glucose needs to be checked.
Can we sit?
Mm.
You pick it. Which one? Which finger? Good number, my friend. You want one or two? Two. No, we can't have 5.
Ethan blows a kiss to his peanut butter cup before he eats it.
Unlike her brother, Walter's sons have received therapies and other services for their autism since they were very young. Walter wonders what would have happened if Beach had received that kind of care. But even with it, she worries about her sons, particularly Ethan.
With someone like Ethan, it's very isolating. It's a very, because you don't know when that behavior is going to pop off with him. You don't. And he's gone after me in the store. And I get it. It looks frightening, you know. And the police have been called, you know, and the police show up in the Target. And I'm just like, no, no. Like, they come in and I'm like, back the hell up. And they're just like, what? I'm like, back up. Back up. I got it. He's autistic. He's nonverbal. He's aggressive. I got it.
And she does. Until the day that maybe she doesn't. Walter worries all the time about what will happen when she's not around anymore.
You know, as you age, it just gets harder and harder. Like, yeah, I'm 41, but I've now started thinking, okay, what happens to my kids? And even caring for Darren, I'm like, God, I pray I outlive him. Because I know what's to come for them. Like Ethan, he'd probably die soon after, you know, I passed, because they couldn't do, it's very hard to place someone like Ethan who's aggressive and medical. And then Ryan, I couldn't imagine the heartbreaking positions that he might be placed in, you know?
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Amy Silverman.
And I'm Athena Ankra.
KJZZ is part of the Mental Health Parity Collaborative. The partners on this project include the Carter Center and newsrooms in select states across the country. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, for two Valley pen makers, fountain pens are necessary for survival, but for two very different reasons. But first, GOP state lawmakers are raising alarms about the financial health of Arizona's program for residents with developmental disabilities. The chair of the House Appropriations Committee, David Livingston, accuses the governor's office of allowing spending on the DDD program to exceed the amount set aside for it by roughly $100 million. A big part of that appears to be the Parents as Paid Caregivers program. This COVID-era program allows parents of minor children with disabilities to essentially be paid by the state to be their children's caretakers. There's a shortage of people to take care of this population of kids. That problem was made worse during the pandemic, when many people were nervous about allowing other people into their homes. We have two perspectives on this today, starting with David Livingston, a Republican from Peoria. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with some perspective on the state of the DDD program relative to the rest of the state budget.
As appropriations chairman, my primary job is to balance the budget for the House and the Senate and the governor and be in that team. The PPPC program is the one that you just asked me about. And the governor's team literally spent over $100 million more than they were allocated in the last 12 months on that plan. And that's why we're having so many problems.
So what is the solution, do you think? I mean, how do you think these families should be trying to get care for their kids?
So that's a really hard thing, because these kids and these families really love this program and it really helps them. It allows moms and dads to get paid to take care of the disabled kids because they can't get outside services because there's not enough people employed to come out and help the kids. We will have to put restrictions on it. We just can't grow a program by $100 million a year without ramps and guardrails. So we've talked about a whole bunch of things and nothing decided, but maybe we have to limit who gets into the program. Maybe you have to be a citizen for the state of Arizona for 1 year. Right now, you can move to Arizona and get benefits the very next month. Maybe we have to cap the total benefits. Maybe we need to cap the number of hours per week. There's a proposal to do maximum 40 hours a week paid. We may have to lower the payout rates on some of these. All of those things we're in discussions with, and others.
Would you imagine that those changes, whichever go into effect, would those be prospective, or might you be reducing benefits to people who are already getting them?
Well, kind of both. I don't think we would go backwards on anything unless there was fraud that we know of. But I think existing mom and dads should expect that they should have some type of reduced benefits at some level. We just don't know what that's going to be yet.
So you referenced the fact that there really aren't enough caregivers, you know, or service providers to help these kids. So I guess what would you say to parents who will ask you, what are we supposed to do without this money that we'd be getting?
And that's a difficult question, because there isn't an easy solution. You know, this program started under COVID, and it was like, okay, providers don't want to go out to people's homes, but the kids need services at the homes. Here's a way to do that. And the feds paid 100% of it. And last year, the feds stopped paying 100% of it, and now they're not paying anymore. And the state just can't absorb that. I mean, 5 years ago, this wasn't even out there. But you just can't eliminate the program either. So, and there's no way we'll have enough people to do it. And frankly, some of the people that were doing the job, the mom and dads don't trust having these people come to the house and do this. So it's very difficult, I feel, for the families.
I'm curious, sort of on a philosophical level, what you consider the state's responsibility to these families and these children to be. Like, what do you think the state owes this group of people?
I don't know if owes is the right word, but I think we need to show respect. We need to say, look, we are trying, but we can't do it all. And you don't want the state doing it all either. So we're listening to them. We're talking to them. I've talked to lots of moms and dads. I've done a lot of phone calls and a lot of Zoom meetings. And some of them have ideals on how to reduce expenses too. And we're trying to incorporate all of that. And capping the number of hours per week of the services that we pay for at home is one of the answers. Is it 40 hours? Is it 30 hours? I don't know. But there will be a cap of some type on that. That would be one of the changes. And most of the parents I've spoke to think that's a reasonable one too. Another one is we'll probably limit how often families can switch providers, the agencies that they use. We don't want parents going to agency to agency to agency trying to get the highest payouts. And there's very few that do that, but there is some. And that's a little fix also to help prevent kind of the fraud side of it.
Do you get the sense that there is a lot of fraud in this program?
No, not a lot.
Is there a way, do you think, for the state to incentivize more people to become providers? And I know the state pays them just like they pay the families, but I wonder if that would be advantageous for the state to have more non-parent caregivers for this population of kids.
I think we could do a little more there. We could promote it more within the community colleges and those type of things. I think people that want to become nurses or PAs and those type of things, we could maybe have an incentive that, hey, they do this for a year or two while they're going to school and get paid to do it. So they start learning how to deal with kids and disabled kids, even if that's not their specialty, whatever even a dentist. I mean, anything in healthcare, I think those are the type of people we want doing this. So that's a good idea. We've talked about that. We're trying to figure out how to possibly do that.
Does that save the state money, though? Because the state still pays, my understanding is the state still pays providers, you know, the caregivers, the same as it does parents. It's just a different entity getting the money, right?
Exactly. So, it wouldn't save. But even now, even with $100 million of additional expenses going to that, not all the kids are getting the services they may need. And that's why it's just so complicated.
Yeah. What can the state do, I guess, to try to make sure that, you know, as many kids as possible get the kind of care and services they need? Because to your point, there are kids, even with this extra money, who aren't getting it. And even some of the ones who are getting some care probably aren't getting all of the care that they could probably use.
Yeah, I think the doctors and the people we use that set guidelines on what type of care and how much care, they have to realize we have financial constraints too. And we want to make sure the right kids are getting the right services at the right level. And the program really wasn't set up to do that. It was like almost anybody could sign up for almost anything with a couple little sign-offs. And I think we need to be a little more careful on that eligibility. And we may have to, you know, wait a year or two before we allow anyone new to come in the program too. That's another thing that's on the table. And I think we need to focus on the kids that have the most needs versus the kids that have just a few needs.
State Representative David Livingston, a Peoria Republican, is chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. Advocates for those with developmental disabilities have been trying to convince Livingston to hear a bill that would allocate supplemental money to this program before next fiscal year's budget is completed. Livingston, though, says he doesn't think that's going to happen, and an effort to bring the proposal up at a committee hearing yesterday was unsuccessful. We also reached out to the governor's office for a comment on this. In a statement, she says in part, quote, "Extremist legislators are weaponizing a routine part of budgeting to force hurt for Arizonans with developmental disabilities and their caregivers," end quote. One of those advocates pushing for action is Brandy Kuhn. She's a mom and caregiver. Her oldest son has cerebral palsy and epilepsy and requires a wheelchair and other equipment. She's also a leader in a caregiver support group. And when she spoke with Mark Brody, he asked what she's hearing from her community about the situation going on with DDD and the Parents as Caregivers program.
So the general sentiment from other caregivers in our community is that they are extremely worried, stressed, and confused about the entire process and the threat of DDD funding being terminated by May or June of this year or, drastically reduced. Navigating the legislative process is extremely difficult for most people, let alone those who are doing 24-hour caregiving on top of it.
Are you a part of that program?
I am, yes.
So, like, what would it mean for you if you were not able to collect that money from the state anymore, or if they made some kind of changes to it?
So it would mean a few different things, one of which it would put our household in some financial difficulty trying to meet ends meet because my son's care requirements don't go away overnight. They are still there. I would be doing similar work. So he has, his bathing and care and transfer needs met, but it would mean that I am no longer employed in that position. So doing that extraordinary care for free.
Have you had any success in the past being able to find a provider to come to your house to help take care of your son?
I have had some success with finding caregivers for my son. Typically, I am pulling from my own immediate family or friends, people we attend church with, to fill those caregiving roles. I am, by and large, extremely flexible with the people that we work with, and I fill in the gaps on a weekly basis when they're unable to come at their scheduled times or they have their own family emergencies. The ability for state agencies to find competent and reliable caregivers for the majority of the DDD population is extremely difficult. Often the wages are at or lower than typical entry-level jobs, and obviously, caregiving and providing personal care to individuals with disabilities is a lot more stressful, a lot more work than jobs you can get, working at a grocery store or fast food restaurant.
Are there any changes to this program that would work for you that you would be okay with? Things like maybe capping the number of hours per week a parent could be reimbursed for, or things like total benefits or maybe lower payouts, things like that. Things that legislators are talking about potentially doing. Like, are there changes that you would advocate for as a way to maybe keep the program going, but also deal with the state budget?
Yes, and that has been something I've personally shared with multiple representatives. So Access and Medicaid are coming out with some safeguards around the Parents as Paid Caregivers program that was scheduled to come out when this program was made permanent, but is going into effect in 2025. And those two things are a 40-hour cap for Parents as Paid Caregivers. And that will, even if the child qualifies for extraordinary care above and beyond 40 hours, the parents of minor children will be limited to only 40 hours per week of care per member. The other thing that's going into effect in 2025, and Access is already ahead of this, trying to ensure that all hours that they authorize through DDD are qualified as extraordinary care. And what that means is it's any care or task or goal that a child of a similar age with typical development would not be able to do.
Does that cap work for you? Like, is that a change that seems reasonable to you?
I do think that 40-hour cap is a reasonable safeguard for the program. I do think there are a few situations I've heard of families with very high needs children in rural areas who could benefit from flexibility in that rule. But I think by and large, that is a reasonable accommodation we could make to this program to ensure budget cuts are kept in mind as we ensure disability services are in place for those who need them.
So how do you reconcile sort of the needs of this program and the fact that it has over the last, number of months spent more money than expected? How do you reconcile that with, the needs of families like yours for this program with the need of the legislature and the governor to balance the state budget?
Yeah, so the need to balance the state budget is a high priority and something that all citizens of Arizona should be mindful of and engaged with. My perspective and understanding with DDD services and the cost increases is that we also need to understand the counter costs that we're preventing by having comprehensive DDD or home and community-based services. There's several research studies out there that show that institutionalization, more hospitalizations, higher group home percentages within our population causes costs for Medicaid to increase. And so by our state legislature fully funding disability services and in the home and community, they are actually saving hundreds of millions of dollars in medical care and hospitalizations for these same individuals.
So you mentioned the May 1st situation here, and I know that you have asked for lawmakers to take up a supplemental funding bill for this program through the end of this fiscal year. It doesn't, frankly, sound like that's going to happen. So I wonder what level of optimism you have that things will continue to run smoothly. And even if, the program does continue, let's say the legislature passes a budget in June, that's potentially a month or more of there being uncertainty or maybe a gap in coverage here.
Yeah, it's hard to describe what the fallout would be if there was a gap in coverage for members that qualify for DDD services. It's not just the Parents as Paid Caregiver program that we're discussing. It's therapies, it's group homes, it's day programs, it's early intervention, it's nursing care. So things that people rely on a daily basis for their physical well-being and supervision and safety will be immediately impacted if that is turned off overnight.
Brandy Kuhn is a mother and caregiver and a leader in a caregiver support group, and you're listening to the show. Good morning, it's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. State press reporters Natalia Jarrett and Andrew Durst recently wrote a piece about the changing political codes of fashion. The whole thing started when Jarrett went to a Charlie Kirk event at ASU and was surprised to see someone there with buzzed, bleach blonde hair wearing scuffed Doc Martens.
At first, I couldn't tell if he was there to just watch like I was, or to maybe protest even. But then Charlie Kirk started throwing out MAGA hats and he took one and put it on his head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, Andrew, I take it this was resonant for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So she was, I think it was like the day after this event, we were in our newsroom at the State Press and we were having a similar discussion, just kind of just random, just having a conversation about another employee was discussing like, oh, does this like sweater make me look liberal or conservative? And so we were thinking about that. And then she kind of told me this anecdote. And we're like, wait, there's definitely something there because this is like a wider phenomenon that we had kind of observed.
Yeah. Well, so in the piece, you guys don't just write about these anecdotal experiences that you have. You interview a number of sources who really expand this out and give it quite a wide scope, including going all the way back to the French Revolution.
Yeah. Well, I reached out to John Ortved. He's a contributor to Vogue and the New York Times. And I found him because he wrote a piece about the history of subcultures And he was basically just telling me that it's kind of always been this way where subcultures will get co-opted. And yeah, he mentioned the French Revolution where people began to dress poor because it became the cool thing to do, or it made them seem more relatable, which they liked.
Yeah. Well, and so then you in the piece make a connection to conservative teens at a Trump rally. I assume that was a different event than the Kirk event.
So we went when Trump came to Mullett Arena, which is on ASU's campus. It's our hockey stadium, on October 24th, I want to say. The vibe there was kind of weird. People really weren't super excited to talk about their fashion.
I mean, yeah, it's hard to tell if that's just because how journalists are looked at from, you know, the different.
Yes, I've been to Trump rallies to try to ask people questions myself.
Exactly.
It's an interesting experience.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was kind of like pulling teeth to get them to talk. I mean, I feel like the questions were pretty lighthearted. We'd just be like, what are you wearing or what are you interested in? And they'd be like, jorts. And that's it.
But what you were noticing, to be clear, was kind of a skater aesthetic, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Baggy jeans or like Sambas or cool shoes. We'd be like, okay, that person looks like they skate. So we'd walk up to them. And there were a few people that said they skated. And that was just very interesting to us because skating has a lot of anti-conformist ties to it. And I mean, that's not to say that someone who's conservative can't skate, but I'm sure there's a lot of like real authentic skaters that would say the opposite.
Right. Well, this is one of the really fascinating things to me that you guys point out in the piece is you could argue that a Trump rally is a fairly establishment affirming space, but whereas it used to be almost a slur to be called a poser, the kind of person who would wear subcultural clothing or anti-establishment clothing without actually believing in that cause, that's not so much a concern now because it's become more of an aesthetic.
Subculture has shrunk as the internet has grown because you can really participate and I use air quotes there in anything by just watching videos about it and feeling like you're a part of it. You can see, you know, consume skater or punk content, and you can say, I want to dress like that, and I'm going to do that. But then in real life, you're not really within any kind of subculture for that. And there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. But poser isn't really a thing that people call people anymore, at least in terms of kind of the subcultures that we're talking about. It's kind of been a shift because of the internet to just viewing clothes as just something you wear and that can look cool and you can express yourself with them, but not actually understanding what that expression comes from.
I mean, I can certainly remember, several decades older than you, but I can remember being in middle school or high school where it was like, you know, the coolest kids at school, the most establishment kids at school, they wore Abercrombie and Fitch flannel shirts. And if you were wearing like knockoff versions of those because you couldn't afford Abercrombie and Fitch, you were the one who got called a poser. You were trying to pose as establishment. And now it seems like there's this inversion.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the last time I really remember people getting called posers was in middle school. If you wore like a Thrasher hoodie, you would definitely be like, you don't skate.
Right.
But now I feel like that's all kind of gone away. And I'm not going to go up to someone wearing a band shirt and say, like, name three songs. But I do think, like, that would not have been cool in the 90s even.
You mean like in the 90s it wouldn't have been cool to wear like a Pixies shirt and not be able to name three Pixies songs?
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But now you can and you don't even know, you don't have to know who the Pixies are.
Yeah. Not to overuse this Pixies analogy, but you're making me think that there was a time prior to the broad availability of these various aesthetics right there in the palm of your hand. There was this way in which you wouldn't even know who the Pixies were unless, I don't know, your parents listened to them or you had like some cool or uncool, I guess, depending on your point of view, sibling or friend who turned you on to them. So in order to even get a hold of that shirt or think of it as something you wanted to wear, you kind of had to have the cultural experience, whereas now it can be delivered to you in this way that decontextualizes it a little bit.
Exactly. And I think people lose understanding of where things came from or what they mean. And I mean, like, even Kurt Cobain, he used to say things like, or he would just talk about how he didn't like the fan base or the audience they were reaching because it'd be a lot of, like, white male influence that didn't get the lyrics or what he was writing about.
Well, see, that's a really interesting point because, I mean, we're now, when we talk about Kurt Cobain, we're talking about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Even then, before the internet was, I mean, even existed, in at least in terms of broad availability, there was still this sense of movements and aesthetics being co-opted. It seems like maybe the internet has, like, supercharged this thing that was already happening.
Exactly.
That actually leads me to my last question for you guys, which is the note that you end your piece on, which I thought was really interesting, which it seemed like the stance that you were taking, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that broadly speaking, liberals have maybe been a little bit too quick to assume that people dressed a certain way agree with them.
I think from who we talked to and what we learned, that is what we were saying. I think people have gotten too comfortable.
The confidence before the election of the Democratic Party was very, very high. And I think the same way that people were pretty confident, you know, you could see someone wearing exactly these outfits that we described. And if you take off the MAGA hat, I would say 9 times out of 10, I could know this guy's politics and start a conversation with him about it. But clearly, the country is not exactly where people thought it was. So I think this is, yeah, really indicative of that kind of larger shift. And it may seem like just fashion, but at the end of the day, fashion reflects the moment we are in culturally.
All right. Well, Natalia Jarrett and Andrew Durst wrote about this for the State Press. Natalia and Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning once again. Welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman, and to close today, we bring you the next chapter in our Analogs series about people who make things by hand and what those things tell us about those people.
We figure it's about 80, 90 years old.
Even though the technology is so rudimentary, you can have a lot more control.
It has lately, in the last 15 years, turned into more of a passion type of thing.
I needed an escape.
Okay, Jake, I have to be kind of quiet because Adrian is asleep, but check it out.
I took this video on my phone on July 16th of 2020 at 11:36 p.m. It was the depths of the quarantine, and my then-fiancé Adrian and I were staying in a small cottage on a friend's farm. The cottage had no doors, and I stayed up much later than Adrian, so I had made a habit of tiptoeing around at night. Usually, I just sat at a desk in the living room and wrote in my journal. But on this particular night, I had to film this video to send to my brother Jake, because I had just gotten a very exciting package in the mail. In the video, I am holding a cylindrical metal case with the letter K etched into it. I unscrew the top and reveal a fountain pen.
Whoa. Okay, I gotta figure out how to open it.
The pen is called the Decagraph, designed by a company called Kara's Customs. That's what the K stands for. Jake and I had been texting about the Decagraph for weeks. Jake is actually the whole reason that I got obsessed with fountain pens. He was into them way before me. And when I asked him what he liked about them, he said this thing that I have never forgotten. What's beautiful about fountain pens, Jake told me, is the nib, the bottom part of the pen that the ink flows through. The nibs are soft, and that means that when you start writing with a fountain pen, the nib subtly changes shape based on the way you hold it, which means that the way the ink flows is dictated by the writer's hand, which means that when you write with a fountain pen, the words come out in a way that only you can write them, which means that in the days leading up to the arrival of my Decagraph, I was so excited that I had been texting Jake screenshots of the status of the shipment. And in that video I sent him the night it finally arrived, I filmed myself using it to write the words, "Hello, Jake," in my journal.
Oh my God, it's so good.
I have a confession to make. I came up with this entire series about people who make and use analog tools as an excuse to talk to Bill Karas, the founder of Karas Customs, makers of the Decagraph. Not long after I moved to Arizona last year, I discovered that Karas Customs is located in Mesa, just 20 minutes down the road from the radio station. And going to visit Bill was one of my very first story pitches here at the show. And just so I make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, is it Karas?
Karas, yep.
Karas,
yep.
Okay, great. And so, last spring, I pulled up outside a low-slung, dark stone warehouse in Mesa and knocked on the door. Bill came out and shook hands with me. He's a soft-spoken, serious guy with glasses and a shaggy, graying beard. We sat down in his office, which is decorated with automotive posters. That's how Bill started making things. He used to tinker with old cars back when he was a teenager.
Well, I cut the top off of my dad's Carmagia and turned it into a convertible, so it was a little more.
No way.
That car never saw the road, so it was a learning experience.
Okay.
Pretty much. Yeah.
As he got older, Bill got better at customizing cars and eventually went into business designing and building machine parts of all kinds. And now that's what his company, Karas Customs, does. They build tools and parts for everything from bandsaws to airplanes. It turns out that the whole pen business happened by accident. One of Bill's employees noticed that pens were having a resurgence and suggested that Karas Customs should try making one. Bill was intrigued, not so much by the idea of designing a pen, but because he was looking for ways to have a little bit more control over his business.
We were always trying to work towards making our own product instead of just making parts for other customers.
Okay, okay. Now, you can probably hear a little bit of disappointment in my voice there, right? I guess I was hoping Bill was going to say that he started making pens because he wanted to help writers write words that only they could write.
I wish I could say we did that. Yeah, honestly, no. No, definitely not. I'm not a pen guy. I have to think about what we're going to do for business, how we're going to make money, you know, how we're going to... Right. Everybody's going to get a paycheck, and the pens are a good way to do that.
Yeah. So the goal for you is not how do I make the best fountain pen necessarily. It's how do I make the thing well.
Yes.
To Bill's credit, he recognized that people were craving good quality pens, and he figured out how to make them. And these days, he told me, pens are 70% of Karas Customs' business. But I was really hoping that my visit to Karas Customs would give me that same feeling I had the night I first unboxed my Decagraph. And when I got back to the station, I think show producer Amber Victoria Singer could see it on my face. Because a few months later, she emailed me and said, I think I found somebody else for you to talk to.
My name is Tamara Rowland. My pronouns are she, her. I am the owner of Write 365 Custom Pens.
All right. And we are in your garage/workshop?
Workshop. Yeah, this is the workshop where the magic happens. It's nothing super fancy.
Tamara also started making pens by accident, but her story is a little different than Bill's.
I am a transgender woman, and I came out as transgender a little over 2 years ago. Over the last number of years, I've done a lot of journaling and introspection, just sitting down and writing my thoughts and reflecting on my past and thinking about my future.
It was a big deal for Tamara to start journaling. Growing up, she knew there was something different about her, and she was terrified that someone might find out.
I actually went through life, most of my life, paranoid that people could read the thoughts in my head. That led me to a life of, you know, repressing and pushing away all those thoughts and feelings, saying if I adhere to this expectation of what society thinks I should be, this perfect man and husband and father and all of that, that those thoughts will go away.
As she got older, Tamara did get married to a woman and they had two kids. And as she got further and further from the person she knew she really was, she tried to tamp down her feelings with alcohol. It got to the point where she was drinking every day.
I was desperate. I was... Basically, I didn't want to go on. You know, I couldn't reconcile my insides with my life. And, you know, I had thoughts that I don't want to continue with this life. But if I go away, they're going to find out.
Thankfully, Tamara got help for her drinking. She went to a rehab program, and while she was there, they suggested that instead of trying to wash her feelings away with booze, she should write them down. At first, Tamara couldn't bring herself to write the truth about everything she'd been through. But the more she kept at it, the more she came to treasure her writing sessions.
I needed an escape. It changed from being an escape to being a true, like, active meditation.
Around this time, Tamara took a woodworking class, and she decided to try making herself a pen to journal with.
I'm like, well, I want to make a pen for me. I think there's some meaning here, like this personal connection that I found. I'm like, okay, this is mine and no one else has it, and these are my thoughts going through it.
It took a few tries, but when Tamara finally made a fountain pen that worked, she could feel the difference.
When I'm writing and I'm journaling for me, I reach for that fountain pen. People who really get into fountain pens can be very particular about the feel between the nib and the paper, because to them, that's their connection to, you know, the words that are flowing out, right? And it can be very personal.
Before long, Tamara had made a few dozen pens, and she decided to start selling them. She builds her pens in small batches, spending hours in her garage working under a pride flag and a large rack where she stores her kids' bikes for when they visit. Some of Tamara's pens are made of wood. She likes ironwood and maple in particular, but she also makes them out of colorful resins, which she mixes herself. In its raw form, the resin looks sort of like corn syrup. Tamara adds dyes and powders to it, and then, once it hardens into a form resembling the body of a pen, she turns it on the lathe. That, she says, is her favorite part.
It can come out of the mold, and it can look pretty plain. It can look, here's one that looks mostly green with a little bit of gray in it or silver. But once this is turned, it's going to be a world of swirls inside there. And I love, like, revealing that art, you know? I love revealing what's inside that's not shown on the outside.
Special thanks this week to producer Amber Victoria Singer. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman. Well, thank you so much for listening to The Show on this Thursday. We will be right back here with you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for our weekly news cap and so much more. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, once again, I'm Sam Dingman, and we'll talk to you then.